Welcome to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Mike Thompson. It is Tech Tuesday on All Sides. Next summer, EA Sports' popular college football video game will return for the first time since 2013, this time using the name, image, and likeness of all your favorite college players. And it's a new era in college sports. And joining us to discuss the new game, as well as what's going on with esports at Ohio State University, is John Price. He's the manager of the OSU esports arena and program. John, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me, Mike. It's great to be here.
What does the manager of the Ohio State University esports and arena program do?
Well, I oversee a facility of about 4,000 square feet with about 90 gaming PCs and make sure that's available for all the students here on the Columbus campus. And in addition to that, I also oversee our esports program. So we have four different competitive teams that play intercollegiately against other schools and compete on the national stage in a variety of different video games.
So what was the recruiting class for the EA sports athletes? I mean, we always hear this with football and basketball, but this is really kind of it's out there. It is huge, but a lot of traditional sports fans don't know it's there, but it's growing.
It's huge, and there are scholarships, full rides that exist at a variety of universities. Players go from the collegiate league up to the professionals as well. In many ways, it mirrors some of the different aspects of what traditional athletics looks like right now.
So what does the competition look like? Is there a season? Is there are there practices? Are there rules and regulations that the athletes, e-athletes, must follow?
Mm-hmm. The answer is yes to all of those. So there are weekly practices. There are competitions concerning a variety of different. There's no draft yet, so maybe one day, but
okay.
No draft.
Yep.
But these competitors are competing at a high level against other universities in similar situations. There are yearly debates. One of the biggest ones is whether or not students that are remotely off of a campus should be allowed to play as part of a university team. So there are plenty of controversies, just like anyone else.
Is it regulated by an organization? Does the NCAA get involved in this?
The NCAA does not get involved with it yet, though I know for a fact they've had plenty of talks. It's a little complicated when you start getting to intellectual property in video games, though. So and as for regulations, there are some third-party groups that have formed, but there are some NCAA conferences that have already added esports, and so they have their own rules for it. It's a hodgepodge.
Now, forgive my ignorance, but what kind of games are they playing? Are they playing Call of Duty? Are they playing, you know, baseball, basketball? What are they playing?
Yes. I know. It's a lot of yeses. But for example, Call of Duty, one of the club teams here at Ohio State, they're actually the 15th in the nation for Call of Duty. But the four teams that are here at Ohio State specifically that are endorsed by the university are Rocket League, think soccer with cars, League of Legends, Overwatch 2, there we go, and Valorant. And so those are the four main titles that we currently play. Mm-hmm. And there's some of the more popular ones out there.
Is it a fall season, spring season?
We try to have one off season, one on season. One of the interesting things about esports, though, is there's no requirement. There's not going to you could theoretically be playing all year round, and there are some schools and some players that do. We try to not do that for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
But it's definitely out there.
Interesting. It's just a whole new world. And is there a transfer portal in esports?
There might as well be at this point. It's very easy for students to go from one place to another because there just aren't any rules about transferring. There aren't any rules about eligibility. There are graduate students play, of course, in college athletics as well. But there is not like you have 4 years and that's it, unless the league that you're playing in has that rule. There's nothing kind of holding it all together.
Yeah, it's kind of, we weren't around when college athletics got going and college football got going more than 100 years ago, but you have to wonder if this is similar to the questions they all faced back in the late 1800s.
I often, when I'm talking to others about it, I often compare it to then, because we're really in many ways writing the book. And I always say we should probably borrow from the other group that have also already done this, but you know, it's still at the beginning and everyone's trying to figure out how different really is esports from traditional sports.
Yeah, it's always amazing when you see people that they come to arenas to watch people play esports. Well, how boring is that? Well, how many people sit and watch golf every Sunday and Saturday afternoon? It can't be any less exciting than that, or any more exciting than that. Oh. People love watching golf, and myself included. So. Yeah.
Oh, exactly. And it's a kind of every year, pretty much, League of Legends, a world champion, they sell out a stadium within 5 minutes, like the Staples Center and everything else. So there's an audience.
Yep. So getting to the video game aspect of it, there is the EA Sports college football video game has not been out since 2013. That's 10 years ago. It's not going to come out until next year. Mm-hmm. And that's for a couple of reasons. One was the Ed O'Bannon suit, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, there was a lawsuit, an antitrust lawsuit that was brought against the NCAA concerning labor practices. And that's kind of one of the interesting aspects of esports in many ways, or video games in general's impact on sports, is that lawsuit and this video game in many ways formed the basis of what now the NIL is for college athletics. It provided really one of the catalysts that forced that conversation to move forward in the courts.
Yeah. So, and that suit was settled, but also the Supreme Court ruled that Ed O'Bannon would deserve some compensation. I mean, he wasn't even a student when he was. It was an alumni game or, yeah, you know, an archive game when he was well out of college at UCLA. And then, of course, the NCAA, that opens a whole can of worms as to how you compensate. Do you compensate athletes for their number? Mm-hmm. I mean, if you have a quarterback on your college football game and he's wearing a number 7 – we know who that is. Should C.J. Stroud be compensated for having his number 7 and his arm and his scrambling ability on a video game?
Yeah, no, for sure. And that was an interesting situation that happened. And the other aspect is that they actually would use some of the facial imaging and such of the actual players in the game. They'd modify it to make it like distinct, but we all knew who it was.
Yeah, and now where this is going to happen in from next year. Mm-hmm. What's taking so long to get this going? There was hope that it could even come out this year.
Mm-hmm. I think some of the big things, especially in game development, when you're working with this many legal pieces, because it's not like there's one entity they can negotiate with and get all the NIL rights to. They have to pretty much go through each school in some way, shape, or form to get these because of that. And so it adds a lot of extra. So I can understand why it took as long as it did, because they're essentially renegotiating with every school and then each one of those players in a way.
Yeah, because you would almost have to negotiate with each player, because the player doesn't have to sign on with the school's NIL system. The schools have set up a system to try to help the players. Mm-hmm. Some argue try to control the players, but try to recruit players. Mm-hmm. It's a whole new world. What will these games look like?
Well, I think a lot of it, or at least the hopes for fans, is it's going to be a return to what it was. Kind of like you said, it's been 10 years since the last one. These are very popular titles and such. Sports fans in particular, they love playing some of the different dynasty modes. They love playing the college teams that, you know, they grew up with, essentially. And so I think for a lot of fans, they're just excited to be able to go back and actually play it after a decade of it being on, because it used to be a celebration. I remember when I played football back in high school, and every time it was come out, we'd all be talking about, oh, can't wait to try it out, and then I'd try to beat up each other. And yeah, and it usually did not go well for myself, but it'll be an event for sure.
Players, can they opt out? Do you know?
That I am not aware of. I'd imagine that must be a possibility, but it's one of those things that I am not sure of.
We joked about the transfer portal with the EA Sports, but that has to be even trickier with college athletics. Now you don't have to stay with the team for 3 or 4 years anymore.
Yeah, I really wonder how they're going to be integrating that into the game, and what, or even how NIL will be integrated into the game itself.
Yeah. The right, how are the negotiate? You're not involved in negotiations with the EA Sports with Ohio State, but they're negotiating with the leagues, and they're starting with the big schools first. They're not. This, like the Ohio States, the Notre Dames, the Michigans, right. Oklahoma. That's where they're starting first.
Yeah. No, I imagine so, just because those Power 5 schools and such have a lot of leveraging and will likely set kind of the rules for what the rest of the schools end up going with. It's just one of those situations when you have this, so many of these different aspects happening, those Power 5 do have a lot of control for setting the table.
Because there are concerns. Are you going to include the lower schools? You know, the schools like, you know, the sub-tier, the Ohio University, those Akron and Kent, and even the historically black colleges and universities, you wonder if they're going to be included as well.
Yeah, no.
The Big Ten commissioner previously worked at a video game company, Activision Blizzard. this again shows the overlap between esports and traditional sports.
Yeah, that was an exciting one. I only found that out about a week ago when the trade-off just had happened. And it turned out he, for about a year, Tony, I'm forgetting his last name.
Tony Petetti.
Petetti, yeah. Yep. Worked at Blizzard Activision for about a year. He did long history in MLB and a variety of other things before that. But Blizzard Activision is very well known for not only esports, but just as a gaming company in general. Call of Duty, World of Warcraft, Overwatch are just three in particular that come to mind. And so when he was there, he held the title of, I want to say, sports executive and such. And specifically, esports was one of those things under him. And so I know for myself and many others in Big Ten are excited about the prospect of, might that mean something in the future? Because Big Ten conference does not currently have esports as one of its recognized activities or anything like that.
Uh-huh. And that day is coming. By basically what you told me, it's selling out the Staples Center in LA. That day has to be coming.
Yeah, no, I think there's no question. It's just a matter of time. And we're really, I think, kind of at the precipice of that. And especially even this year, to give you an idea, I was hired here at Ohio State about a year ago, and I was the first person to be hired full time to do esports. And I was one of three other hires that happened that same month in the Big Ten. The University of Maryland hired Sergio Black, and Michigan State University hired Chris Blinsky, all for full-time esports director manager positions. And I think that's just kind of a testament of where there's something coming, and what it'll be, I'm not sure, but it's going to be big.
If someone is interested in esports, can you go watch the OSU esports team?
Yeah, you can. We actually have a twitch.tv channel at Ohio ST Esports, or you can find us online at esports.osu.edu, and we have links to our Twitch as well as our Twitter, where you can see us post updates and such about when we do compete. And we're currently pretty much off for the summer, but we'll be back here early fall. We have tryouts in the first week of the semester, so students can start getting onto some of the rosters and get practicing.
Interesting. And then, but there's no central location. You can't go to the Shot and watch folks right now, or even the Covelli Arena or someplace like that.
No, we don't have a specific kind of a stadium to play in yet, but you can watch and come to the facility itself if you're a student. But we also do tours for the public as well, and a lot of times we have a designated area just for the players for competition and practice, and so you can see them there as well.
Interesting. It's a whole new world. 25 years from now, it might just be, of course, we're going to do esports. Will we get 110,000 people to come watch an esports? Maybe not, but who knows? Anyway, John Price, manager of the Ohio State University esports arena and program, we thank you for joining us here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides.
It was a pleasure, Mike.
When we come back, AI and the military, something completely different when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to the Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides from 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Mike Thompson. The use of artificial intelligence in military combat conjures up war game scenarios unlike any real war experience. This new high-tech version of the nuclear arms race worries Henry Kissinger, the veteran diplomat and former Secretary of State, who spoke recently to CBS This Morning.
It's going to be different because in the previous arms races, you could develop plausible theories of how you might prevail. It's a totally new problem.
That's Henry Kissinger, who recently turned 100. Journalist Tom Shanker is director of the George Washington University's Project for Media and National Security, which works to deepen public understanding of important, often complex, national security issues. He spent decades covering American wars in national security. He is the co-author with Andrew Hohen of the new book, Age of Danger, about the threats artificial intelligence poses to national security. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Thank you, Mike. It's an honor to be with you this morning.
What do you make of Henry Kissinger's comments? It's kind of, you haven't heard from him in a while, and it's kind of cool to hear his voice, and he's just turned 100. He's still with us, but he's worried.
Well, he should be, and he has a century of experience that gives him that right. You know, he came of age during the nuclear age, and you know, of course, nuclear weapons are horrifying. Even just the early versions dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki did just horrific damage. But with nuclear weapons, I think, as Dr. Kissinger would say, there at least was a straight line knowledge of what might happen. They would get more accurate, they would get more destructive, and so on. The challenge with AI, Mike, is what we're talking about today is maybe 10% of what is known. I personally think it's even less. It's like 1%. So we don't even know the threats that AI might pose because it's such a different kind of risk. And so even the best minds like Dr. Kissinger for his era and many younger national security scholars are just deeply worried about the application of AI to military.
Now, the military is already using basic levels of AI in their missile systems to knock down incoming missiles, correct?
That's exactly right. The Patriot anti-missile batteries that the U.S. and NATO allies are sharing with Ukraine absolutely have a piece of AI. When an incoming missile is about to land on top of you, there's not time to pull out either your abacus or your iPad and chart the trajectory. So these machines take over. But Mike, it's called eyes on, hands off. There's still a human in the loop, and the human can either launch sooner or abort the launch or let the machine do what it's supposed to do to knock down that incoming missile. The challenge is that as missiles get faster, like the hypersonics being fielded by China, or in cyber attacks, which happens at network speeds, there's simply not time for a human to be involved. And how we manage that is the challenge.
How about other weapon systems using AI right now? Are there any others? We see drones, but they're pretty much all human operated though.
Well, drones can be a fire and forget. You put a program into it, it looks for the target. Once the target in the drone's brain matches the target on the ground, it launches ordnance. We already have cruise missiles launched by aircraft or submarines that have AI. They have these terrain mapping systems inside of them that they get there on their own and drop the ordnance. So there's actually a lot of AI. And of course, the sort of, we think of the Terminator aspect, these killer robots. And this could be in some ways a more positive application of AI. Perhaps the day will come when the first soldier through the door of an enemy complex is a robot and not a human. And that would be a positive thing.
Interesting. We're talking with Tom Shanker. He's the director of the Project for Media and National Security at George Washington University. We're talking about the use of AI in the military. It is here and it is likely to expand. And that has a lot of folks concerned as to how folks can maintain human control over these systems, which are could be more and more automated and using artificial intelligence in the years and decades to come. You know, humans make mistakes in war as well with these weapon systems. Friendly fire, we saw with the tapes during the Iraq war, how the drones fired on innocent civilians by mistake. Could AI help with those things?
Mike, it's a great question. It could both help and it could hurt. Because as you've said, systems that had humans at the controls, firing weapons, commanding drones, innocents have been killed, whether at a wedding party where people were firing weapons in the air for celebration, or, Doctors Without Borders hospitals that just weren't on the military's maps have been bombed as enemy units. So if humans can do that, well, when humans put the programs into AI, they are only as good as the humans programming them. So while AI can take data faster, assess data faster, understand data faster. It doesn't have human intellect or empathy to be able to make decisions based on anything beyond the straight data that it's given. And if that data is coded wrong, it's going to make a wrong decision.
But when you talk about these hypersonic weapons and the need to be, you know, instantaneous in your decision making, it seems like we need the AI. Militaries are going to need the AI to counter threats from others.
That's absolutely right. The argument will be if an adversary, we don't have to call it China or Russia, but if an adversary fields a hypersonic weapon that doesn't come the traditional route, which is over the North Pole, that's the flight that has been, you know, watched for incoming ICBMs for decades. Hypersonics allow you to come from any direction where perhaps we don't have quite as developed a radar suite. So if we don't spot an incoming hypersonic until it's minutes or seconds away from an American target, the military will argue you have to let AI deal with that threat.
And what is the danger? Obviously, a false alarm.
A false alarm. If it's a commercial airliner that has strayed, if it's anything else, you know. So how do you make sure that this AI system that assesses, decides, and acts has some kind of empathy to say, huh, might that be a civilian airliner? Might that be a small plane? Might that be a weather balloon? Might it be an anomaly, a cloud formation? And so once again, it's up to the programs to save us from error. And as we know, humans commit a lot of errors, unfortunately.
Will we get there? I mean, it seems like we're going to have to get there, but we're still in the infancy, more or less, in this. And one would hope that we will get there, that we will have the programs that can tell those things apart, that can spot a false alarm and not do bad things without cause. Can we get there?
Well, I think that is the hope. And one can imagine a very complicated coding system or algorithm, whatever proper word you want to use, that would encompass all of the details that would allow the system to separate a hypersonic weapon aimed at us from a commercial airliner. Absolutely. But then there's another risk. How do you keep these machines from assigning themselves missions that perhaps we don't want? I mean, the whole Terminator series was about how these, you know, AI systems became sentient and began deciding for themselves. We're nowhere near that, but a program could regenerate its own options. And that is something that we don't yet have a way to tap the brakes.
So this reminds me of the earliest days of the Cold War, when nuclear proliferation was just exploding and there were arms control agreements, and the superpowers, mainly the U.S. and the Soviet Union, were able to, especially after the Cuban Missile Crisis, were able to tap the brakes and say, okay, hold on, let's put something in line to sort of at least prevent an accident. Do you see, what's the current state of that right now internationally?
Mm-hmm. The current state is zero. there is nothing going on in that space, Mike. And as we discussed a bit earlier, arms control over nuclear weapons, as challenging as it was, at least was dealing with finite quantities of things. Missiles, warheads, multiple warheads, the routes they flew were well known. The problem with AI is, as I said, to use your perfect word, it's in its infancy, and we don't even know where it's going, what it might produce, what it could possibly do. So how do you write arms control or even laws for a system that you cannot even imagine where it will be a year or two from now? That's the challenge.
What is being done to try to address this? Is there anything being done to try to at least start these discussions?
Well, I'm talking to you from Washington, D.C., and it's great to be talking to folks out there in Ohio. You know, last week in Congress, there were hearings that were asking these exact questions, Mike. There were absolutely no answers. But clearly, there needs to be, you know, in our book, Age of Danger, we make the case that as we redefine national security away from strictly talking about things that blow up and kill people and looking at things like AI, climate, food security, and all that, these questions cannot be solved by the government alone. And since AI is mostly being created in the private sector, we need to have new partnerships between the government and the private sector, Because again, only governments were fielding nuclear arms. So when you and Dr. Kissinger cite historic arms control, that was government to government. But AI is being created by private sector companies that are marketing it on their own. So there has to be some kumbaya, arm-in-arm, shoulder-to-shoulder effort between the U.S. government and all of the tech giants.
How is that different than the relationship the government had with private defense contractors during the Cold War, who were designing the Patriot missile systems, designing the airplanes and the submarines that we were using for our nuclear arsenal?
Sure. Those systems were contracted by DOD, paid by DOD, and then became the possession of DOD. I mean, no private contractor fielded a wing of F-16 fighters, right? Only the government. Yeah. But as we enter this new age of danger that my co-author Andy Hohn and I call it, you may have private tech companies able to field AI of incredible power. And you may have state actors and non-state actors, rogues and terrorists, using AI in ways that they never could have used a nuclear weapon, thank God, because AI, you can put it on your thumb drive.
And you have to think about weapons differently, too. We're not just talking about bombs and missiles. There's cyber attacks. There's disinformation. And that's also something that has to be addressed.
That's so true. You know, if we were having this conversation 10, 12 years ago, the cyber Pearl Harbor that folks in Washington would have talked about would be, you know, an adversary turning off the lights on the Eastern Seaboard or crashing the financial system. Andy and I in our book make the case that, you know, cyber Pearl Harbor might already have happened, Mike, and it was quiet, and it was the Chinese theft of intellectual property and tech designs worth billions and billions and billions of dollars. It's no surprise that China's newest generation of stealth fighter looks a lot like ours. So when you get into the AI world, we can't forget the whole range of cyber, and as you said, election fraud and election interference, disinformation and misinformation, all of which can be accelerated and strengthened if using the muscle of AI behind them.
Again, going back to the Cold War, there were two superpowers, the United States, the Soviet Union. They were able to keep a lid on the nuclear threat. Now it's, you know, the United States, possibly Russia, China for sure. Those, you can see those countries working together, working out the differences and trying to set some ground rules. But then you have other actors, North Korea, Iran, that could also be a threat.
Well, and even, you know, 18-year-old kids programming at the kitchen table in their boxer shorts over a bowl of cereal. I mean, the challenge with AI is it's a very democratic weapon. Not the party, but small d democratic. Yeah. Everybody is going to have access to AI, and it can be used for nefarious ends by an A to Z range of adversaries far beyond bipolar and tripolar that we've had over the past decades.
Are you optimistic we can overcome this? It's kind of depressing.
Oh, I'm actually not optimistic, and we haven't even talked about some of the real doomsday scenarios. You know, I joke that Andy and I want people to read our book, but I mean, we want people to buy our book, yeah, but maybe not read it, because it'll keep you up at night. There are really smart thinkers out there, Mike, who are deeply concerned that as we get into DNA sampling and genetic coding, that you could apply AI magnificent brain power to solving illnesses, curing diseases, but also creating illnesses and creating diseases targeted at an individual based on his or her chromosomes, or to a certain set of people based on theirs. And if I was writing my next screenplay, that would be it. Although it's truly so terrifying to me that we raise it in our book not to keep people awake at night, Mike, but because people need to think about, as you've said, limits on what AI is used for.
What's another doomsday scenario that plausibly could happen?
Well, it's so interesting. Whenever I hear Dr. Kissinger's voice, I know he wasn't exactly the role model for Peter Sellers in Dr. Strangelove, yeah, but for all of your listeners of a certain generation, you know, as you know, the Soviet premier put the entire nuclear stockpile under control of a computer, that if the Soviet Union was ever attacked, everything would be launched all at once. Problem was, he hadn't told the world about it. He was waiting to the party Congress. And so there's a rogue American attack, and the end of the world is guaranteed because nobody can turn off the computer.
And you can see that an AI situation that, I mean, that's fiction, that's science fiction back in the day, but it was based in some reality.
Right. I mean, one can imagine that the U.S. government would never put its entire arsenal under AI. But as we talked about, some of these defensive systems and some of these retaliatory systems, one by one by one by one, could be on AI, and they could respond to something that fits the code perfectly, but does not fit the reality.
Now, ChatGPT became a big story probably like 2 months ago when they released it publicly, and all of a sudden everything's AI, AI, AI. And that's kind of the way we in the media are. We glob onto something and it becomes a huge issue, and then maybe it fades away, maybe it doesn't. But this has been going on for a while, correct? We just haven't been paying attention.
Exactly right. We talked about the Patriot anti-missile defense batteries had AI for a long time. Other parts of computers have AI. Lots of utility operating systems have AI. You know, and the ChatGPT thing, I mean, it was a fun story, and questions of, will ChatGPT do your kids' homework so they don't have to? Okay, that's bad.
Yeah.
But if ChatGPT can take over administrative functions that are boring and mindless, well, that's okay. But again, ChatGPT is, you know, a tiny, tiny single-digit percentage of what AI is going to do. So we kind of got all excited about, you know, just the first inkling of AI, and we should be really afraid of what's out there.
So bottom line, make you king for a day, what's the first step that governments, industry needs to do to try to prevent these doomsday scenarios?
Sure. Just like the government has a strict regimen controlling nuclear materials and nuclear technology and nuclear know-how, the government needs to work with private sector to, of course, encourage the free market development, but to have real strict limits on what is done, who has access to it, when and how.
The human involvement is key, correct? At some point in these decision processes?
Hands off, but eyes always on.
Is that possible under these scenarios you talk about, where you have to make really instantaneous decisions?
That's the challenge that we're talking about.
Yeah.
At some point, if you want to save a city from attack, and the attack might come in a matter of seconds or in cyber at net speed, you'll have to surrender some decision-making to AI. And that is the zone of risk in this new age of danger.
Interesting. Well, I hope you all sleep well tonight, but it gives us plenty to think about. We're talking with Tom Shanker, he's the director of the Project for Media and National Security at George Washington University, talking to us about AI and the military and the challenges we will face in the years and decades to come. Tom Shanker, thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides.
Mike, it was a great discussion. Thank you for having me.
Tech Tuesday continues here on All Sides from 89.7 NPR News.
The Last Ride, a deep dive into a shocking unsolved mystery.
These two young men disappear off the face of the earth, and the last person to see them live was this sheriff's deputy. His stories were so unbelievable.
Listen to The Last Ride podcast, part of the NPR network.
Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides from 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Mike Thompson. Sony is making a return to gaming handhelds, well, sort of. At the company's most recent gaming showcase, it talked about a surprise new device coming later this year. It is called Project Q. Here to tell us more about that and other tech news is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Russell Hawley, welcome back to All Sides.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. So this is Project Q PS5. It is a large screened streaming device. What exactly does this thing look like?
Yeah, so imagine a kind of a small tablet, like an iPad mini with a PlayStation 5 controller kind of split in half and glued to either side of the screen is essentially what you're looking at.
So large screen, it's not my like 50-inch TV where I was watching basketball last night. Not that large. It still fits in your hands.
That's right. It's larger than the screen you'd see on Nintendo's Switch handheld or on Valve's Steam Deck, which are the two kind of big handheld devices that you can buy right now. This is Sony kind of getting into that game. Sony's done a bunch of work with handhelds in the past, most notably as the PlayStation Portable, which was really, kind of popular during the kind of PS2, PS3 days. And when we got the PlayStation 4, there was an effort to move that kind of gameplay so that it streamed onto your phone or a tablet or something like that. And the funny thing about phones is that if you're playing a game on it, you can't then, surf the internet or TikTok or anything like that. So it wasn't as popular as they were hoping it was going to be. So this is now, kind of a standalone thing for playing your PlayStation 5 games.
The Sony Vita, another handheld, launched 10 years ago, ended in 2018. What did the company learn from that experience?
Oh, all of the wrong things. So the PlayStation Vita was actually like technologically pretty far ahead of its time. It used mini disc technology and a couple of different other really cool things to play. It was unfortunately really expensive. The games that were originally released for it weren't super great. Sony made a big deal out of the ability to surf Facebook on the PS Vita, so it just didn't survive, and it was never as popular as the PlayStation Portable.
So what is for gamers, where do they want to play? Do they want to play on these handhelds? Do they want to play on their computers, the big consoles at home? Where does the gaming industry stand now? Is it all of the above?
So that's the thing, is it really is all of the above. You're always going to have people who want to be able to play their games on the brightest, biggest, and most beautiful screen that they can find so that they only play their games at home. There are other people who are happy to play games for a little while on their lunch break, and they're perfectly happy streaming on something like this or just playing on their phone. Really the game streaming, kind of rise comes from people wanting to play the highest quality games kind of wherever they are. Maybe that's a bedroom or out on the porch, or, I'll be honest. I was Memorial Day weekend. I was out at a bar and I saw someone playing a game while they were waiting for friends to show up. They just had a controller wrapped around their phone and they were playing God of War Ragnarok while they waited for other people to show up. So, it really is a mixed bag. There's not one kind of game player anymore.
Now, Wi-Fi causes issues, glitches, buffering. Is the technology pretty seamless?
It's gotten a lot better over the last couple of years. You still can't play, if you're on a train or another super fast, vehicle like that, where you're kind of jumping between networks really, really quickly. But if you're somewhere with even just kind of good Wi-Fi, not necessarily great, or you have a good cellular network, then you can play most games without problems.
And you can play the game as if you were at home. You get the same experience. It's a smaller screen, smaller controllers perhaps, but...
Yeah, it's exactly right. The way that it works right now, if you have the PlayStation app on your phone, for example, or a tablet, it actually wakes up your PlayStation at home when you go to play it and just kind of sends all of the visual information to the screen that you have in your hand.
So this is an extension of what you have at home. You cannot have this without the console at home?
So that's actually a really good question. Sony has not made public announcements for an exclusively streaming, device. And that's entirely what this could end up being. There's a set of earbuds that they're talking about releasing with this to make it so that you kind of have that all-in-one experience. If you've already got the game on your PlayStation 5 at home, then being able to stream it is super advantageous. On the other hand, Microsoft is making a ton of money right now by having a streaming-only service that people pay monthly for, and I'm sure Sony would love to get in on that in a more competitive fashion.
But they don't want to hurt their at-home system sales either, I'm guessing, so they have to sort of find that balance, convenience versus, their current market.
That's exactly right. And the PlayStation 5 is, at the moment, the most popular console in the world. So having that hardware sale means a lot to that company.
Yeah. Any idea what the Project Q PS5 might be? What the price point might be?
There's a lot of speculation there. I would be surprised if Sony goes above $350 for a system like this. But I also said something very similar about their VR headset, which retailed at $500. So what do I know?
How are the sales going for that $500 VR headset?
They were really difficult to get a hold of initially. They're a little easier to get a hold of now, and Sony hasn't released hard numbers for how many have been sold. But there is a constant stream of developers, game developers, who are moving their stuff to the PlayStation Store for those users. So it's got to be big enough that those companies feel like they're making money.
Yeah, they see the road ahead. Moving on to Apple and its mixed reality headset. It's the new virtual reality headset, expected to be called Reality Pro. It's Apple's biggest new product in nearly a decade, and it comes, speaking of big price tags, comes with a pretty big price tag, $3,000. Why so expensive?
Well, there's a lot of things that we don't know about this, and while there's not a ton to confirm this, you know, what I suspect Apple is going to announce at Worldwide Developer Conference, which is what WWDC stands for, is actually a developer kit for people to make VR and AR applications. So, you know, the big speculation right now is that Apple's going to announce that this headset exists and that it's going to be a stunning $3,000. Now, Apple has done stuff like this before, where it's been only available to developers so that they can build things on it, and then a consumer version that is not as expensive is released later. That's something that was seen when Apple first started doing virtual reality hardware testing a couple of years back, where it was, you know, hardware that you could get for you know, your workstation to help build those applications to hold things like multiple graphics cards and, you know, kind of complicated things like that. This headset is something that has been long awaited, you know, as Facebook, you know, kind of gobbles up mind share and market share with its Quest 2 headset and the Quest Pro headset, and Sony trying to kind of wrest some of that attention back with its latest. There are a lot of people who are hoping that Apple steps in and does something that is genuinely interesting here.
So folks who are not really up on the virtual headset and virtual reality, how do these things work? The Quest 2, the Quest Pro, how do we expect this one's going to work?
So the Quest 2 is essentially a small computer that you strap to your face, and it has a couple of screens, and it allows you to do a ton of different things, but you have to either be seated or standing in kind of a cleared area, because you can't actually see much of what's going on in front of you in you know, as clear a way as you would if you were wearing glasses. It's, you know, incredibly useful for education and you know, music and entertainment, but it's not something that you're going to, you know, wander around and carry to a coffee shop or something like that. It's pretty much what you're going to be using either at a desk or somewhere else. The hope with Apple's headset is it's something that is light enough and thin enough that you're going to want to use in more places. It is not going to be something that is as thin as a pair of glasses, because unfortunately, despite our protestations, physics continue to exist. But it is, you know, going to be something that is going to, you know, encourage a lot of companies that hadn't really dipped their toe into the VR or AR spaces to give it a shot, because anytime Apple makes something, the audience that follows it is often quite large.
So will we see people walking down the street at some point wearing these things?
You know, that's the thing that that people who are really excited about augmented reality hope that comes to be at some point. I would say if that reality is headed our way, we're probably 4 or 5 years away from that happening.
Well, that's not that long, 4 or 5 years. No controller with this headset. Instead, it uses eye tracking and hand tracking.
That's right.
That's pretty bold.
Yeah, you know, that's something that that Oculus has started doing through Facebook on its Meta Quest 2 headset. You know, hand tracking is something that has started to get pretty popular, and eye tracking is something that has been tested in a couple of situations, but isn't something that is relied on often for navigation, because accuracy tends to go away depending on the lighting situation that you're in front of. Apple, however, has an enormous amount of experience with things like facial recognition, because we all use our faces to unlock our iPhones now.
Yep.
So having that information is something that gives them kind of a leg up on being able to do effective eye tracking.
Are you surprised, disappointed that virtual reality hasn't come on as much as perhaps many people thought it might, you know, 10 years ago? It's not really totally mainstream yet. A lot of, you know, the hardcore folks are using it, but average folks aren't using it yet.
Yeah, it's really useful in kind of enterprise situations. You know, there are a lot of you know, corporate environments where VR headsets get used for creation and prototyping and things like that. But it's, you know, as long as it is a heavy, you know, kind of bulky piece of plastic that you have to wear on your head, and it gets warm while it is on your head, because again, physics gets in our way. It's really tough to have someone understand what's going on in the headset without putting the headset on. And convincing someone to try it out by putting the headset on is a challenge that none of these companies have really resolved yet.
And a big resolution. You said it's three or four, maybe even 5 years away.
Yeah, if we're going to get something that is light enough that someone's going to wear outside for extended periods of time, that's not something that we have that's technically possible right now.
Interesting. And this is $3,000, but it's mainly, you think it's just targeted towards developers, and the average consumer is not going to rush out and get this thing.
I very seriously suspect that that's the case, but we won't know until Apple makes their announcement at the developers conference, which will be happening on June 5th.
Oh, it's right around the corner. And like all Apple products, they hope to bridge all of their devices with this, so you could use this for email and podcast watching and things like that.
That's the hope, yes, is that you'll be able to, you know, interconnect this with, if you've got a MacBook or an iPhone, possibly even your Apple Watch. I suspect that the sensors in your Apple Watch would be good for, you know, kind of motion gestures and things like that. But we don't know exactly what Apple has in mind just yet.
Interesting. Will this be as big as, you know, other landmark innovations? The iPhone, you know, the iPod over the years that they have, or is this just wait and see if this is going to be as big as they hope?
Yeah, at $3,000, there's no way this is going to be as popular as your Apple Watch or your iPhone, but yeah, it's certainly going to, you know, present a new opportunity for you know, different software developers to kind of reimagine the way that you think about how we use computers every day.
Okay, flip phones. Oh, flip phones. We make fun of folks who have flip phones, but they're getting popular. Some people call them dumb phones. They're on the rise as Gen Z and millennials choose to limit their screen time, so they say. There's even a movement on TikTok, hashtag bring back flip phones. It has 49 million views. Why the interest in flip phones?
Yeah, so I mean, flip phones are small. Even if you have embarrassingly tiny lady pockets on your pants, and you can usually fit a phone in there. You know, there are they often came in a lot of really interesting colors. You know, there are a lot of companies, in particular Nokia, got weird with phone designs when flip phones were popular, and so, you know, there's some uniqueness there. But also, a lot of folks don't know that right around the time that the smartphone kind of revolution happened, a lot of these companies started adding smart features to those flip phones. So they're not nearly as dumb as we remember them. If it's been a long time since you've used a flip phone, you can still get Google Maps with turn-by-turn navigation. You can still, you know, use most modern messaging services. You know, web browsers are still pretty useful. YouTube exists on a lot of these, although TikTok certainly does not. There was a lot that these phones were still capable of as far as what we consider, you know, what are now kind of modern conveniences. So they're not quite as dumb as we remember, but they're also, and this is probably one of the more important things, they're less expensive and they're more durable than your average smartphone.
Really? Because you think of, you know, it's got a hinge. So
it's definitely got a hinge, but I, you know, it's anybody who grew up with Nokia phones has the, you know, that reminder that you could basically hurl them into the ocean and they would still be fine. So, you know, there's a certain amount of durability there. You know, there was a period of time where I would walk into any store and there was a reasonable chance that I would see someone under 20 with a crack on their screen.
Yes.
You know, and that's, you know, just kind of a common thing. And it's a lot harder to do with these phones. So I definitely understand the compulsion. I've used some of these flip phones over the last couple of years, and they're surprisingly capable for what they are. And Nokia is taking advantage of it by bringing back the what is now 16 year old Nokia 2660 with new software and a slightly better camera, but still that, you know, colorful little flip phone that slides into your pocket.
Yeah, I remember right before the iPhone came out, maybe it was simultaneous, the Razr. Was that Motorola had the Razr?
Yep, Motorola's Razr was slightly before the iPhone and was very popular.
Oh, they were the phone to have, you know, and then I was late and then I ended up getting an iPhone. Or I think I got a BlackBerry first. I'm going way back, almost 10 years or so. Anyway, 15
yeah.
years. But yeah, you're right. It has a hinge, but that hinge protects the screen. The cameras and the touch screens, are they as good as your traditional Android or iPhone?
The touch screens have definitely been improved and they're really good. The cameras are not. The cameras are good. They're good enough for, you know, kind of taking the odd picture in decent lighting, but they're nowhere near as capable as your average iPhone or Samsung phone.
Battery life, is the battery?
Oh man, the battery life on these, depending on how you're using them, you can get days out of a single charge. They're, you know, they definitely don't use as much in the way of background processes as what we're used to now.
So does that mean if they're not as robust as an iPhone because they're not computing as much, or they scaled?
That's correct.
Them? Yeah. So you can't do
as much. You're just not doing as much on the phone at the time. And, you know, Apple tends to run a lot of things, you know, kind of simultaneously, which ends up using a fair bit of battery life. Plus, cameras in general consume a ton of battery life. And so, you know, unless you're using this for multiple hours a day for turn-by-turn navigation, you're going to get much better battery life out of a phone like this than you would out of an iPhone of the same, you know, kind of basic level.
And is the cost competitive with other smartphones?
Oh, way less. You know, your average Nokia 2660 is going to run $200 or $300 compared to, you know, the now almost $1,000 that you would pay for a new iPhone.
Who knew? Vinyl came back. When are cassettes coming back? Are they coming back? Flip phones are back.
Cassettes in bookstores. Let's get them back right now.
Please don't bring back the cassettes. We hated cassettes when we had cassettes. Anyway, Russell Hawley, thanks for joining us here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides. We appreciate you here. Russell Hawley is Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thanks for joining us on Tech Tuesday. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.
A lot of people moved out of city centers during the pandemic, and businesses went with them.
This is the classic American donut. People have left the center and moved out to the ring.
I'm Rima Khreis. Donut development, that's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6 on 89.7 NPR News.
Join WOSU Classroom for Second Saturday Kids Day on the road at the Columbus Arts Festival. Meet Nature Cat, make a color-changing bracelet, and more. Join us Saturday morning, June 10th from 9 to 11 at Dorian Green Park at the Columbus Arts Festival. Visit WOSU.org/kidsdays to register for this free event.
This is WOSU-FM and HD1 Columbus, 89.7 NPR News. Global, local.
Now to the showdown over the debt ceiling.
The debt ceiling.
The debt ceiling and avoid major financial fallout.
A potentially catastrophic default.
An unprecedented debt default.
You've heard for weeks about the stalled negotiations over the debt ceiling. This weekend, President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy finally reached a deal. We've got